I'm Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. The Federal Parliament is wrapping up what has been a mixed year for the Turnbull government. It scraped home in the election and now is trailing in the polls. But its members have been heartened by the passage this fortnight of its double dissolution industrial relations legislation, giving it some policy runs on the board, though a lot of concessions have had to be made to achieve that. Next year, energy security and climate change will be two significant items on the government's agenda. These issues are at the heart of the portfolio of Josh Frydenberg, who became Minister for the Environment and Energy in the second Turnbull government. He joins us today to talk about the climate, actual and political, and other issues. Josh Frydenberg, just to start generally, what do you think have been the big political lessons out of this year for the government?
Well, obviously since the election, we've seen some major fault lines in the parliament over the issues of industrial relations, and particularly I'm thinking of what happened with the volunteer firefighters, what has happened with the Registered Organisations Bill and the ABCC, but also prior to the election, what happened on the owner-operator truck drivers. So that's been one fault line. Another has been a fault line over budget repair. And while we got the Omnibus Savings Bill through, there's still a lot more to do. And then clearly in the issue of border protection and immigration, there have been some differences between the major parties. I think the key lesson is that the Parliament is working, that despite the differences between the major political parties on important issues, the coalition has found a way to get important legislation through the parliament with the support of the crossbenchers. And I'm thinking is the best example of that was the Registered Organisations Bill and the good work that's been done on the ABCC. When it comes to other lessons, it's all about ensuring that the people understand the what, the why and the how. And when you talk about the why, the importance of third parties, in the case of the volunteer firefighters, they, in their thousands, turned up on the streets of the Victorian Parliament to make it clear that they didn't want to be part of some union takeover. When you talk about the owner-operator drivers, again, in their thousands, they turned up in their trucks to make it clear that they wanted to be able to operate their businesses as usual, and to ensure that they didn't form part of, you know, again, another union takeover. Those third-party endorsements were extremely important in getting the crossbenchers over the line for what has been good policy and legislative change.
Now, turning to your portfolio, the government's committed to reviewing its climate change policy next year. What exactly is this review going to cover?
We'll have more to say about that before Christmas. But the key is to ensure that we're on track to meet our 2030 targets, which is a 26 to 28% reductions in our emissions by 2030 on 2005 levels. We did beat our first Kyoto target by 128 million tonnes, and we're on track to beat our 2020 target by 78 million tonnes. But clearly the 2030 target is a larger one and a more challenging one. Now, while we have a number of mechanisms in place to reach that target, including the Emissions Reduction Fund, which just had its very successful fourth round and saw an average cost of abatement across those four rounds of $11.83 per tonne. We have the Emissions Reduction Fund, we have the Renewable Energy Target of 23.5% by 2020, we have the work of ARENA and the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, and we have the National Energy Productivity Plan, which aims through new standards for vehicle emissions, for white goods, for buildings, to get greater efficiencies to the tune of 40% by 2030 in energy use, and that could meet up to a quarter of our emissions. So we've got some good mechanisms in place, but we will be looking at the overall settings to ensure we meet our Paris commitments.
And modelling by the Climate Action Tracker suggests that, in fact, we're not going to be on track to meet that target unless more action's taken.
Well, the same people and bodies that say we won't meet our 2030 target were the ones who said we wouldn't meet our 2020 target. The reality is the government's committed to it. It took a decision to ratify its Paris targets. We went to Marrakesh, the foreign minister and I, and were well received, participated in a number of important discussions about reducing emissions, whether it was through the work that we're doing to stop deforestation, whether it's the work through new technologies like carbon capture and storage, smart grids, what we're doing in the efficiency space and the innovation space, joining the Americans and more than 20 other countries in a goal to double our R&D spend on renewable energy technologies by 2020. All this is adding up to a positive picture of Australia meeting its 2030 targets.
But you're hinting, if I'm picking up the signals correctly, that a bit more needs to be done?
Well, it's a constant watching brief, and we understand that we need to ensure that there are the right measures in place to meet those targets.
Now, we know that Malcolm Turnbull gave some commitments about climate policy, sticking to direct action and so on when he was gathering the numbers to be leader, and then when he became Prime Minister and did reached an agreement with the Nationals. So does this limit the scope of what the government can do? In other words, is it in a straitjacket of policy because of the past?
Not at all. We've made it unequivocal that we support a lower emissions future, that our targets are ambitious on a per capita basis. They're above 50%, which is one of the highest in the OECD. But at the same time, we need to be very conscious of the implications of our policy settings for energy security and energy affordability. You see, across the national electricity market, Michelle, there's a major change taking place. Originally, the national energy market, which goes from Port Augusta and Port Lincoln to Port Douglas and includes some 9 million customers. Originally, it was built for dispatchable, synchronous energy generation. Today, we have a very different type of grid and very different type of form of energy generation, namely non-synchronous and more intermittent power, particularly from wind and solar, making its way into the grid. So there needs to be changes to take into account those developments, and that is why we've asked the Chief Scientist, Alan Finkel, to look at energy security through the COAG Energy Council process.
Just before we get to talk about that in more detail, could I ask you, what difference do you think the arrival of Donald Trump in the presidency will make to the international push to deal with climate change?
Well, the US is a critical partner in the tackling of climate change. It's responsible for 16% of the world's emissions, second only to China, which is around 22% of the world's emissions. But as the largest economy in the world, it can also help drive the increased attention and spending on research and development and innovation. And there has been a leadership role that the US has played, and we hope that it continues to play in innovation, in renewable technologies, and in securing energy efficiency. Now, it's too early to say what the exact policies of Donald Trump will be, but he did say certain things in the election campaign. But once we see his cabinet appointments in this space, and once we see him arriving in the Oval Office after January the 20th, I think we'll have a better idea.
You mentioned the climate conference you were at. Did you find that your counterparts from other countries were worried about the Trump presidency for the climate issue?
Well, they all agreed that there was significant momentum in dealing with climate change already, because not just was the Paris Agreement in force in record time, with more than 110 countries ratifying, more than 190 countries adopting the agreement. But you also saw significant agreements to phase out hydrofluorocarbons and Australia had co-chaired with China the working group, which led to that recent outcome. And that's significant because by doing so, it's equivalent to saving 1.5 or nearly 2 years of the world's total emissions. There was also a significant agreement in the international aviation space to reduce emissions. So a lot has been happening together with the Climate Finance Roadmap, which Australia co-chaired with the UK, and the Green Climate Fund, which we co-chaired with South Africa. There's a lot that's been happening to maintain that momentum, you know, regardless of some of the political changes that happen in various countries. Now, of course, everyone is waiting to see what Donald Trump does in this space. But our message is that you can have a lower emissions future with energy affordability, with energy security, and they shouldn't be mutually exclusive.
We've seen in this country, obviously, the rise of populism to an extent. And this week in the industrial relations negotiations, the government's been forced into some populist concessions. I'm wondering what the implication of this trend is for dealing with climate issues. Do you think that the Australian population generally is becoming less concerned with these issues, or as it did, for example, after the GFC, or do you think it's becoming more concerned as we see climate events and their implications?
I don't think you want to underestimate how concerned people are about rising electricity prices. I mean, this feeds right into the competitiveness of our industry, particularly our energy-intensive industries, like cement or steel or aluminium, which employ thousands of people across the country, as well as our mining industries and resources industries. And you've seen quite a contested political debate about the future of coal-fired power stations, for example. So people are very focused on what are the implications for energy pricing.
Didn't the coalition promise to fix this in 2013?
Well, when we abolished the carbon tax, we saw the biggest ever drop in electricity prices. But what people are worried about is the future of electricity prices and their ability to pay them. At the same time, they're also worried about jobs, and they're in those sectors that are particularly energy intensive, and they're worried about energy security. The events in South Australia were a seismic event, and 1.7 million people were without power. Now, there are a number of complex reasons, and that event was instigated by the 1 in 50 year storms that they had in South Australia, but there was a cascading effect across the grid. But it wasn't the first time they had a non-credible event in South Australia which led down to the shutdown of the interconnector, for example. And we've had the Basslink cable shut down for some 6 months between Tasmania and the mainland. So there are lots of, you know, complicated issues with energy security which people are noticing and are wanting, you know, some guarantees that that their energy supply will be continuous and stable. All this is happening while people can see the rise of renewables, the decreased price in renewables, and the inevitable developments in technology, and particularly battery storage. You see, in Australia, you know, we have 1.5 million households who have solar PVs panels on their roofs. This is the highest in the world on a per capita basis, and we're starting to see peer-to-peer trading where people are selling excess power that they're generating from their rooftops to their neighbours. This is an amazing development because it can be done outside the usual structures of of the grid. You're also seeing a virtual power plant in South Australia, which the government helped finance through our ARENA, Australian Renewable Energy Agency, where we've got 1,000 household batteries pulled together, which allows the peak demand to be met by stored pooled energy from individual rooftop solar systems. This is a unique development, the first of its kind really on that scale in the world. And people can see all these developments happening with electric vehicles, with solar PV, with large scale storage, and they don't want those developments to stop, but at the same time they don't want their affordability and security of energy supply compromised.
You mentioned earlier the Finkel review. What do you expect to come out of that for energy security?
Well, obviously, it comes in the wake of the South Australian event, and it comes in the wake of what happened with Basslink, but also the major volatility we saw in June, July in South Australia, where the wholesale spot price went on one day from $500 a megawatt hour to $14,000 a megawatt hour. Huge volatility. So what we're looking to from Finkel is a sense of how we can effectively migrate energy policy and climate change policy and bring them together in a harmonious way, how we can make the national electricity market fit for purpose given these structural changes that are underway, and how we can deal with some of these engineering challenges that are caused by the rise of intermittent power, namely solar and wind. See, when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining, power's not being generated, and batteries are not yet capable to store enough of that energy generated to last through the night or for major large scale commercial operations. Those developments are happening, but they're not there in the way we would want it to be just yet. So what we're looking for is how do we solve some of these engineering challenges that are posed by this intermittent generation, namely what are called frequency control and ancillary services, which include ensuring that there's sufficient inertia in the system, that the absence of coal and hydropower and gas power has meant that we're now relying more on intermittent power, which doesn't have the same characteristics as those other forms of generation. And how do we fill this void that's occurring in the system? So these are engineering issues. These are going to be technology and innovation issues. And we're looking for that sort of advice from Finkel. At the same time, he may provide us with some guidance on the need for more connectivity between states with interconnectors so that when a state is not generating power, it can rely on power from another state. And he might provide some advice about the hardening of infrastructure to deal with extreme weather events as well.
A lot of these are, of course, transition issues as we move to more clean energy. And yet, in the wake of the South Australian blackout, the government tended to demonise renewables rather than simply highlighting that there were some problems during a transition. Was this really about politics, and is this useful?
Well, myself and the Prime Minister were very consistent the whole time during the South Australian blackout, which was there was a extreme weather event. This led to 9 out of the 13 solar farms north of Adelaide closing down. They did so because the settings weren't right on the wind farms. This meant there was a cascading effect across the grid. The interconnector itself couldn't cope, so that then shut itself down. The thermal generators, namely gas, were able to continue through those voltage disturbances, but the wind farms could not. Now, we've consistently said all along that that is what has happened, and AEMO has documented that. But that is different from the issue about the challenges that are posed by a rising use of wind and solar to the stability of the system, because they don't produce the power at the consistent 50 hertz. And we need to solve for that frequency control and ancillary services, and that's what hopefully, and the battery storage issues, and that's hopefully what Alan Finkel can provide some guidance on.
But do you think that there is too much partisanship in this issue about renewables? Because they obviously are the way of the future, the longer-term future.
Renewables are an absolute critical and increasingly important part of the future in energy supply. But it's about getting this transition right and ensuring that we don't have a repeat of the blackout in South Australia, either in that state or other states. And it's ensuring that Australia's competitive advantage in energy pricing remains. And that is a challenge for government to ensure that those trilemma of issues, the security, the affordability and the lower emissions future, can be done simultaneously.
Turning to another issue in your bailiwick, according to the latest underwater surveys, two-thirds of the coral in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef has died. It's under enormous pressure from bleaching caused by the warming ocean. Do you think that government, federal and state, is doing enough to protect the reef, or will more effort be needed?
Well, you're right. The bleaching event was a terrible one, and some 22% of the reef itself had a coral fatality. It was confined, as you say, to the northern part, and it was due to the combination of climate change and the El Niño effect. But it's worth pointing out, Michelle, that in the 3 years leading up to that bleaching event, coral cover increased by some 19%. Now, we are very focused on the long-term health of the reef, and that's why we've put in place with the Queensland Government the Reef 2050 Plan, which will see some $2 billion invested over the next decade. That money is going into improving the practices of farmers to avoid sediment runoff. That is money that's going into ensuring that there are not herbicides and pesticides making their way in vast quantities into the reef, because then those extra nutrients in the water support the growth in the crown of thorn starfish, which is a natural predator to the coral. And we have banned capital dredging in the marine park area. This Queensland government has purchased Springvale Station, which is stopping the runoff from there. There's a whole lot of different factors that are happening, including a major program to help eradicate the crown of thorn starfish. So we are doing lots, and we have made that clear to our colleagues at UNESCO and the World Heritage Committee. And on Thursday, we will be depositing with UNESCO our update report.
Just to finish off on a couple of political fronts, how much of a threat do you think Pauline Hanson will be over the next couple of years, especially in the Queensland election? In the party room this week, one of your Queensland colleagues was saying that core supporters were leaving in droves to go to the Hanson forces. And what should the Liberal and Nationals be doing to meet that threat?
Well, we've certainly seen a rise in the vote for third parties, and Pauline Hanson and her party were able to gain significant votes at the last election, and you ignore that at your peril. The way to deal with it is to listen and to understand people's concerns as to why they have left some of the major parties, and to take action to ensure that they understand the good things that the government is doing and the work that, you know, we can all improve upon too. So I'm confident that people understand that the coalition is absolutely committed to issues like job security, particularly as there are winners and losers from globalisation. I completely understand that people are worried about porous borders and unauthorised migration flows, and the government has taken very strong action in that regard. And there is a lot of good things that are happening on the ground that we need to communicate, as we currently are, but continue to communicate, to ensure that, you know, Pauline Hanson's party doesn't pick up votes at the expense of ours.
But there is a trust deficit, isn't there, in the community, and that's very hard for politicians to deal with, because it means that your policies fall into this atmosphere of distrust. Can you do anything about that?
Well, I think there's a global phenomenon here, and we've seen it with Brexit, and we've seen it with Trump, and we've seen it with Hanson, and, you know, people have been looking for that unconventional leader or result. And through the rise of social media, they have now got a voice in a way that they didn't have previously. And we've also seen, you know, traditional pillars of our in, of our society, the institutional pillars, and I'm thinking here of everything from RSL groups to Rotaries, to churches, indeed to newsprint and the broadsheets. All of those have been, their influence of all of those have been diluted over time, and society has become more fragmented, and people have, you know, developed this new voice through social media where they can air their grievances, legitimate or not, to mass audiences. And I think that is changing the nature of the political debate. All this is happening while globalization has its winners and losers, and people are concerned about job security, they are concerned about extremism, they are concerned about immigration, and these are issues that the government needs to respond to effectively, but also in a considered and measured way, not in a knee-jerk reaction.
A hard political climate. Josh Frydenberg, thank you for talking with us today. That's all from our Conversations podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with you again soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.